So we come back to this concept of the monster. And I would like to talk about the creation of a monster, or in other terms, the Republic of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the RDC. I'm from the Congo, I'm an author, but there's a reason why I started writing. I started writing right after the genocide that took place in Rwanda. Why? Because I'm, you know, come from the neighboring country. I heard from the Nilotics, and I also heard about Bantus. But there was reference made to an ethnic war, that Rwanda was a kind of entity with two tribes, but actually with two castes, if you will, two separate classes. There were the Hutus and the Tutsis. That's how it was presented. The Tutsis were herders, and the Hutus were farmers, agriculturalists. And when a Hutu had a certain number of cows, for example, he became a Tutsi. So, but it was really presented as a kind of separate system where two identities existed. Tutsis and Hutus existed side by side, but there was also a king who managed the system. But once colonization arrived, I'm talking about, of course, Belgium, so two tribes were created, Hutus on the one hand side and Tutsis on the other hand. When actually, and that was also when the term Nilotics and Bantus was coined, and that really led to writing. Because if you speak about Nilotics, so people who come from the Nile basin or Niger, and the Bantus, but if you really look at Africa, if you look at southern Africa, right up to center Africa, whether it be Rwanda, Congo, or Eastern African countries or Central African countries, everybody says a human being is, the word for that is Bantu. So when the people arrived in Africa and asked people who they were, they always answered, I'm a human being. Everybody answered that they were human beings, and therefore the conclusion for the European was that they were Bantus, and they were enshrined in this tribe concept. So for the Europeans, it was simply inconceivable, because they were used to being Belgian, Italians, Germans, pertaining and belonging to a nation state. And then Europe really was only half of what Africa was, and to see these people freely roam a continent that was double the size of Europe was simply something that they couldn't stomach. But Bantu really, at the origin, means a human being, and it also means that we are all alike. But in order to try to extend this nation-state concept, this territory was divided. Cameroon, for example, the river, which actually is the Shrimp River, and Congo, for example, was at the time a 3 million square mile territory. It was encompassing more than the RDC nowadays. Congoville, Brazzaville, the capital of the Congolese kingdom was in Angola. It was the town of Bakongo. But despite that, notion of a human being, this concept of the human being, continues to exist in Congo. We have roughly 250 languages there. It's very difficult, given that we have 2.5 million square miles, and therefore vehicular languages were created, Lingala and Swahili. Lingala is spoken in the north and in the west, and Lingala is spoken, for example, in Brazzaville and in other parts, right up to Gabon. Swahili is spoken in the east and in the south. It's also spoken in Kenya and Zambia, and Rwanda, Burundi, right down to Zimbabwe, Even in South Africa, people understand us when we speak Swahili. So it brings people together. And it somehow also obliterated the idea of nation states and boundaries that need to be respected. But what is Congo nowadays? Congo was created back then. I wrote a novel called Congo Incorporated. And The Testament of Bismarck, that's my last novel. Why did I call it Congo Incorporated? Why? Because it translates this new deal that affects this new country. Congo Incorporated is a label like Nike or Coca-Cola. In this case, it is Congo, but I do believe it's on a par. Why? Because Congo is the first natural reserve for natural resources in the world. It is the important territory where, for example, gold, coltan, and rare earths are exploited. So we're the first provider of natural resource of raw materials, and the title is also flanked by a Bismarck quote, and this is also an excerpt on the flap cover where Bismarck says that Congo is destined to be the principal executioner of the works that we have before us. He says this at the closing of the Congress in Berlin in 1885. It was a kind of G20 of the time. It wasn't a great conference like this one here or other ones. They were roughly 20 around the table. And it was not about partitioning Africa, as it was long time believed to be the case, but it was about free trade in this country. And there were two territories that were the focus, the area of Congo and Niger. And it was part of globalization as well. Now we also see that there's uranium in Niger, and we have jihadists there. So these are countries that are in the midst of conflicts, both Congo and Niger. So Bismarck said that Congo is destined to be the principal executioner of our works. But what works is he referring to? I called Congo Incorporated a kind of algorithm. It shows that the world needs to sort of win a bargain, to develop. Whenever big things need to be developed in the world, you need a kind of concept that is incorporated, really, or that is embodied by Congo Incorporated. But what was necessary? First of all, it was important to delineate Congo and to then declare it a free trade zone. That was, from the beginning, the real aim. And despite the fact that the nation-state was created, Congo, to this day, is first and foremost a free trade zone. It is not a sovereign state like other states. Sovereignty really only affects the fact, or is only down to the fact, that the people live on this territory, and they're all traumatized in a way, and they cling together because of this traumatic past. That is the only link. And we speak the same languages on top of it. And 1885... is not any arbitrary date. It is the beginning of industrialization. It is the moment where Congo comes into the equation. At that point, Congo provides the entire world with natural rubber. Of course, there were certain plantations already in Manaus and Brazil. These are lianas, creepers that grow along the trees, and that was used at the beginning of industrialization. Without rubber, industrialization wouldn't exist, nothing at all. So rubber had to be harvested in the trees. You had to cut the creeper, the liana, in order to harvest the precious liquid. So you could not cut them down to go about it on the floor of the forest, so you had to go up into the trees. And there's hardly anybody who will climb that high. You would have to pay them very, very dearly. And that is the point at which the rules then were applied to Congo. So it was clearly determined that people were not going to be paid very well simply because they go about this dangerous job. So what they did is they created an army. And the Force Publique, private army created by the Belgians, was installed. And it is that Force Publique, that private army, that did the dirty work. So the Force Publique, the army, enforced and pushed people to start working. That is where the first great massacres happened, where we've seen these pictures of cut hands. That was a commercial strategy, by the way. Cutting hands was not just simply for cruel, arbitrary reasons. No, no. There was a clear purpose behind that. Soldiers, whenever they were sent out on a mission, they had to protect, of course, the harvest of rubber. But I'm talking about a commercial activity here. I'm not talking about some arbitrary cruelty here. These are purely commercial reasons. So there had to be a profit there. So soldiers who were sent out, well, first of all, rubber had to be produced. So you had to oblige people to produce. So first of all, they went about killing everyone who was like a mile away, just like that, just gratuitously. And once you arrive on the location, we just point to that example and say, you don't want to work? Well, that's what's going to happen to you. So killing, death, mutilation, that was part and parcel of a commercial strategy. It's as simple as that. So the hands were what? So the soldiers went out on a mission. They went 3-4 days. They came back 6 days. So during these 6 days, they had to eat. So what did they do? So they started on a mission. So what they did is that they shot an ape, for example, and the Belgian official said, no, no, we shouldn't just shoot around here. What we want to have is we want to have a certificate, a justification for any bullet shot. And you need to produce the hand of the person that you shoot if you use a bullet. So if you kill 12 people, you have to produce 12 right-hand hands, for example. That was the commercial reason to save bullets. And then there was also blackmail, because in order to feed the soldiers, they would simply take the women hostage, and in order to liberate the women, husbands were forced to bring the rubber. So the wife was taken hostage, the worker harvested rubber, and he had to come back with rubber and, for example, a goat. The goat served to nourish the troops. So that's how it started. And then the wife was, of course, returned to the husband. So it was very severe. So with Bismarck and the conference, industry relations starts. But why did Bismarck speak about this specifically? There was also a representative of Leopold II at this conference. But it wasn't he who spoke. It was Bismarck who spoke about Congo, because Bismarck was the boss of Europe. He was the godfather, if you will. So he spoke. And it wasn't up to Belgians to speak. That's why I say that the Belgians were actually just a useful force. And Congo, of course, was simply seen as a useful storage for precious raw materials. You have to know, of course, that Germans had already developed synthetic rubber since 1914. Everyone else was still using natural rubber. But just imagine the war without rubber. So if there hadn't existed rubber, everybody would have been, still riding their horses, like the Poles charging against the German tanks in 1939. Things would have been completely different. And you needed to have domesticated rubber plants. Domesticated rubber plants are planted. Natural rubber exists in the forest, but then you started setting up plantations in Malaysia and other countries. But you need 6 or 7 years before such a domesticated rubber plant can start producing in any major way. So Leopold II simply benefited from his head start that he had. He had a head start of 6 or 7 years, so that was a very important aspect. So they needed this rubber, but it wasn't just Belgium that consumed this rubber, but it was the whole world. It was a world market. So Leopold II, II, and Congo were already part and parcel of that globalization effort. And all of that was also part of, those are the rules also of production that I'm referring to. You needed some rules in order to ensure that the world continued developing. So after 1914, 1918, and this brings me back to the algorithm Congo Incorporated, the war 1939 to 1945 is the next sort of major milestone where the destruction reaches its pinnacle with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the uranium that served to build the nuclear bomb was exploited in the Congo. And that, of course, then led to nuclear deterrence, which ensured peace in Europe. And after the Second World War, you can speak about the Cold War, but the Cold War between the two superpowers existed, and Congo had a major role to play there. It was about copper, and there are images that really struck me when I was a small child about Vietnam. You could see helicopters flying, you could see machine gun fire ripping through the trees. What about Congo? Congo was very rich at that time. The Congo worked very well. The mines in Congo worked very well. And the men that worked for Mobutu were everywhere in the theater of operations in Africa. Because the Cold War, let's face it, was only cold in the West. But in Africa, in Asia, in South America, you had liberation wars. In Africa, you had the struggle against apartheid, everything else. So it was only cold around here, but it was hot everywhere else. And in Africa, it was once again the Congolese soldiers who were first in the forefront of the fight. Why? Because Mobutu was the policeman in Africa, a role that was later taken on by Kagame in Rwanda, for example. So when things happen just like that, it's not just about Congo and Rwanda, but it is, you know, the role that Kagame's men are playing in Congo was the role that Mobutu's men played in the previous decades. So President Mobutu was very much the same. So we actually also fought against the FPR in Rwanda in 1990. So somebody had to do the dirty work for the West. And that's how the algorithm works. But it doesn't work with raw materials, but it works actually with humans, which is a very precious resource as well. And then the Cold War ended. The Cold War ended. And the idea was then, well, what about the Congo now? Then it was no longer about men, about war. It was about certain raw materials. And there's globalization that really takes off. High technology, high tech shows up. And that's where Congo once again has a contribution to make. And it's rare earths, for example, coltan and cassiterite. Coltan is, for example, the equivalent of what rubber used to be then. 90% of the coltan that is used in high-end instruments all over the world, like smartphones, is coltan that is exploited in Congo. What is it really? Actually, it's a kind of material that can store a lot of energy. With just a little bit of that, you can actually store a lot of energy. So it's very small, it's very concentrated. And smartphones wouldn't be as flat as that if it weren't for coltan. So we have huge sort of bricks of mobile phones. So you use it. So high tech is largely dependent on that. It is also used in oil industry for LED, for example. LED that are ubiquitous now, are in our cars, in our homes, everywhere. They also use coltan. I think there was I once took out an LED, and the LED continued to work even when it was no longer connected to the electricity grid, and I said, wow, what has the world come to? So this brings us once again back to the time of Leopold II. And then, of course, there's the war. Why is there still a war going on? Why? Because it is the most efficient way. If you don't make war, then you have to ask for licenses, for mining licenses, you have to pay taxes, you need to have an authorization, government authorization provided to you, a permit. You need to set up your center of production according to the rules. You need infrastructure that is always very costly. And you have to pay taxes. You have to pay the workforce. Lots of investments in times of cost saving. We have to achieve a maximum margin. It's very, very difficult. So the war is the most effective way of cutting those corners. You simply point the gun at a guy and he starts working. And they continue. In Congo, this war economy has already led to the death of 6 million people. And 500,000 women have been raped and then mutilated, either with guns or with knives. You know, using a knife, the woman doesn't die. She just bleeds. So that's the damage that is done. But I mean, a rape. So people then start going away from that territory, and you then take possession of that territory. So, and that leads to slavery. That exists in the territories where coltan is being exploited as we speak by the relevant companies. But, you know, I'll keep it very, very short, really, at this point. But if you see this, you see that Congo never changed. This way of conducting the economy has existed since Leopold II. It has never changed. It's not about presidents that are being elected, but it's heads of an executive branch. Somebody's nominated, and they're not really presidents. Mobutu was such a case. He came to power through a coup, and after Mobutu, we had Kabila, the father, who was quickly killed because he didn't stick to the rules. And after that, young Kabila came in out of the blue. One day, suddenly, he arrived in Congo, and voila, he's the new president. And of course, elections and debates. It's not something that you just are served on a silver platter. You need to earn your elected post. But with Kabila, that wasn't the case. He simply parachuted into the country right out of the blue and was declared president after his father was killed, and that's it. So power is not gained that way. You need to work for it. But he is the head of a state council, and he needs to, you know, report to the shareholders, who are the real holders of power. That's the creation of Congo, the creation of a monster. And that's why I keep it this short, because that is the situation, and it is a typical example of a monster state. So what's going on? What can we do now? Well, tomorrow we will have a conference with Brigitte Köster, and we will talk about the reinvention of future. And that's all that we have to do, that is left to do. We need to reinvent the future. And of course, the artists are trailblazers in that sense. I see that artists are doing the work. They're trying to understand, wrap their minds, and scientists as well. But about Congo, that is kind of a sort of a gray area. People don't speak about that. They don't really venture into it. But the artist still exists. Painters, sculptors, not too many authors, but they exist. So what is left to do? We have to reinvent the future. I do believe that at one point we have reached the end of a certain historic development. principles that no longer hold true. The principles of the 20th century are no longer valid today. So I believe that perhaps now we've reached a juncture to start reflecting upon this altogether, because the history of the Congo is not a history that is simply limited to the Congo. I mean, rubber is used everywhere in the world. Coltan is used everywhere in the world. And afterwards you realize that the history of the world, development of the world, would have taken a completely different course if it hadn't been for Congo. So perhaps now we should start thinking about new approaches, new ways of developing an economy. There are new solutions, new voices can be heard, new pathways are being delineated, are being defined as we speak. And perhaps tomorrow we will be speaking as of the reinvention of future, and we will see what happens. Thank you very much. This is the Voice of Africa.